The letter to the Romans, we've reached the 9th chapter, and we start a new section at the 19th verse. Romans chapter 9 and verse 19 to the end of the chapter, still dealing with the question of election and the justice and the fairness of God in choosing some and bypassing others. See in verse 19 that Paul imagines an imaginary opponent standing up and accusing God of injustice. You will say to me then, why does God still find fault with us? For who can resist God's will? And Paul's answer to that question is, who are you, a mere man, to answer back to God? Will what is molded say to its molder, why have you made me thus? Has the potter no right over the clay to make out of the same lump one vessel for beauty and another for menial use? And what if God, desiring to show his wrath and to make known his power, what if God has endured with much patience the vessels of wrath made for destruction in order to make known the riches of his glory for the vessels of mercy which he has prepared beforehand for glory? Even us, whom he has called not only from the Jews, but also from the Gentiles. As indeed God says in Hosea, those who were not my people I will call my people, and her who was not beloved I will call my beloved. And in the very place where it was said to them, you are not my people, they will be called the sons of the living God. And Isaiah cries out concerning Israel, although the number of the sons of Israel be as the sand of the sea, yet only a remnant of them will be saved, for the Lord will execute his sentence upon the earth with rigor and dispatch. And as the same Isaiah predicted, if the Lord of hosts had not left us children, then we would have fared like Sodom and been made like Gomorrah. What shall we say then? That the Gentile outsiders who did not pursue righteousness have attained it, that is, righteousness through faith. But Israel, the insiders who pursued the righteousness which is based on law, did not succeed in fulfilling that law. And why? Because they did not pursue it through faith, but as it were based on works. And they have stumbled over the stumbling stone, as it is written in Isaiah, behold, I am laying in Zion a stone that will make men stumble, a rock that will make them fall. But he who believes in him will not be put to shame. Amen. May the Lord add a blessing to the reading of his holy word and grant us an understanding. In the passage which we read this morning from Romans chapter 9, you may have noticed that in verses 19 to 24, you have no less than six questions. Starting at verse 19, why does God still find fault? Question mark. Who can resist God's will? Question mark. Who are you to answer back to God? Question mark. Will what is molded say to its molder, why have you made me thus? Question mark. Has the potter no right over the clay? Question mark. And what if God endured the vessels of wrath in order to make known the riches of his glory for the vessels of mercy? What about it? Question mark. And these six questions are the measure of Paul's agitation and concern about this whole issue of the electing grace of God. And what he's trying to do is this, and it's something that men have been trying to do for 2,000 years. He's trying to hold a proper balance between the absolute sovereignty and lordship of God on the one hand, so that God has the first and the last say in a man's salvation, and on the other hand, he's trying to do justice to the freedom of man. Man's freedom to choose Christ or to reject Christ. He's trying to balance the sovereignty of God with the freedom of man's will. And this long series of questions is a witness to Paul's earnestness and his desire to do justice to both God and man in the issue of election. But in fact, these six questions are not the first questions that are asked in this chapter. If you look at verse 14, you'll see that he asks, what shall we say then? Is there injustice with God? And he has to ask this question in verse 14, because in the previous verses, in verses 6 to 13, he has been speaking about the electing grace of God as it moves through three generations. In the first generation, the generation of Abraham and Sarah, electing grace showed itself in the choice of Isaac and the setting aside of Ishmael. On into the next generation, which is the generation of Isaac and Rebekah, the electing grace of God showed itself in the choice of Jacob, the scoundrel, and the setting aside of Esau, who was Jacob's twin brother. And on into the next generation, the generation of Jacob with his 12 sons and their families, from whom the sons of Israel came. Paul says that they are not all Israelites who are descended from Jacob. Not all the sons of Israel, Jacob, are true Israelites. In other words, they're not all true followers of God. Some of them are simply the children of flesh. They are nominal Jews. They're Jews on the outside. They've been circumcised, and they keep the Passover. But some of them are Jews on the inside. Their hearts have been circumcised and separated to belong to God. And so, from Jacob, one man, come two Israels. There is an Israel after the flesh, and there is an Israel after the spirit. There are those who are the children of God by nature and by creation. But there are those who are the sons and daughters of God by grace. From one man come two churches. You see, the electing grace of God cuts through the generations of men. And that's why Paul asks in verse 14, is there injustice with God? If God cuts through generations like this and separates men and separates families, is there fairness with God? Do we have no say in the matter? Do we just sit back passively and do nothing and wait till something happens to us? Or are you not a free creature in the eyes of God? Free to say yes to Jesus Christ or no to Jesus Christ? Is there injustice with God? And of course, the answer to that is that there is no injustice with God, and there cannot be injustice with God, because in verses 14 to 18, Paul holds up Pharaoh, whose heart was hardened by God. And here again, we cannot really complain about injustice on God's part in his treatment of Pharaoh. I think that although people say these are amongst the hardest verses in the Bible, we cannot really complain about God's treatment of Pharaoh for two reasons. The first reason is this. If you read the story of Pharaoh in Exodus, it is very plain that here was a man who was persuaded and determined that God was not going to come into his life. You see, God, for Pharaoh, this awful God of the Hebrews, was an intrusion. God was an interference with his life. God was an embarrassment to him. Just as God, I may say, is an intrusion and an embarrassment and an interference to people's lives today. And so seven times we read in the book of Exodus that Pharaoh hardened his heart against the Lord. Now you know that seven is the perfect number in Scripture. And what that means is that here was a man who was absolutely and perfectly purposed that God wasn't going to come in and interfere with his life. Seven times. And so the eighth time, we read, the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart. You can't complain about that, can you? There is no unfairness or injustice in God confirming what is already the case. see there are people who spend their lives shutting Christ out of their lives. They don't want Christ in their lives or their homes or interfering with their marriages or how they spend their time or their business affairs. You cannot complain if at the end of the day these men and women discover that they are incapable of responding to Christ. Pharaoh hardened his heart against the Lord. So the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart. You can't complain about that. But there's a second good reason why we can't complain about God being unjust with Pharaoh. You see, Paul tells us in Romans that Pharaoh was raised up by God to show forth God's power so that God's name might be proclaimed throughout all the earth. In verse 17. Now, my friend, are you going to complain about injustice in God for setting aside one man, this tuppence halfpenny tin pot Pharaoh, this little tyrant? Ramses II was his name. This non-entity plastered with gold. You're surely not going to complain about God setting aside this one man in order to bring forth salvation for countless millions. Who's going to complain about that? And so the answer to the question in verse 14 is there injustice with God? And of course there isn't. How could there be injustice in a God of perfect righteousness, of perfect holiness and perfect love? It is impossible, and it is unthinkable. And that brings us to verse 19, where new questions are asked, particularly in verse 19. You will say to me then, why does God still find fault? For who can resist God's will? If all this is true, who can fight against God? And that question in verse 19 is the start of this series of six questions, taking you down to the end of verse 24. And many of the Christian commentators point out here that this very question in verse 19, why does God still find fault, is an improper question. In a sense, you have to ask it. And yet, at the same time, to ask such a question of God is impropriety. Because the question, why then does God find fault, is a question that borders on presumption and ought not to be asked by mere sinner man. That's why Paul says in verse 20, who are you, a mere man, to answer back to God? And the rest of chapter 9 addresses itself to this problem. And this is really what I want to say this morning, that from verse 19 to the end of the chapter, Paul holds up to us three broken things. In verses 19 to 24, he's speaking about broken clay. In verses 25 and 26, he speaks about a broken marriage. In the marriage of Hosea to Gomer. And in verses 27 and 29, he's speaking about a broken nation, quoting from Isaiah and his teaching on the remnant. And each of these preaches a message to us this morning. There's a message from the broken clay. There is a message from the broken marriage. And there is a message from the broken nation. Now, first of all, the broken clay in verses 20, the second half of the 20th verse. Will what is molded say to its molder, why have you made me thus? Has the potter no right over the clay to make out of the same lump one vessel for beauty and another for menial use? And here you have the well-known analogy of the potter and the clay. And if ever you've visited a potter's shop, you may have seen how the man works. He sits in front of the wheel, and the wheel spins, and every so often he puts a slab of wet clay on the wheel, and he starts to mold the clay as the wheel turns, and up goes the pot. And sometimes the shape is wrong, so he smashes the clay and starts again. And if it's the wrong shape, smashes the clay and starts again. Sometimes he may discover that the fault lies in the clay, and so he throws it away and starts with a new lump. And he starts again, and up goes the vessel, and the vessel takes shape. Sometimes he makes grand dishes for the king's presence in the dining room. And sometimes he makes common dishes for the servants in the kitchen. But Paul's point is, you never in all your life heard a piece of clay saying to the potter, why have you made me like this? You see, the end product is entirely in the mind and the purpose of the potter. And it's up to God to say what's going to happen to the clay. I wonder if you're familiar with these words from the book of Jeremiah. Listen to these words from Jeremiah 13. The word that came to Jeremiah from the Lord. Arise and go down to the potter's house, and there I will let you hear my words. Of course, Jeremiah heard the words by watching the potter. He watched a scene, and he heard the words. So Jeremiah says, I went down to the potter's house, and there he was, working at his wheel. And the vessel he was making of clay was spoiled in the potter's hand. And so he reworked it into another vessel, as it seemed good to the potter to do. Then the word of the Lord came to me, O house of Israel, can I not do with you as this potter has done? Behold, like the clay in the potter's hand, so are you in my hand, O house of Israel. And here are the telling words from that story. Another vessel, like the clay, so are you, as it seemed good to the potter so to do. Got it? Another vessel. Like the clay, so are you, as it seemed good to the potter so to do. And the message is the message of the potter's sovereignty. Just as the potter has the first and the last word with the clay, so under the good hands of God's providence and God's grace towards you, God has the first and the last word. God's right to this cannot be challenged, and God's ability to do this cannot be challenged. As has sometimes been said, the word God with a capital letter does not have a plural. The word God with a little g has plurals. Men say their prayers to gods. But God with a capital letter has no plural. There is a sovereignty to God. But that's not the whole truth that is taught here in this passage. Because although man is clay, he is clay with a difference. He is clay with a conscience and clay with a soul. You see, we are clay, but we are clay able to respond to Jesus Christ and the word of the gospel. And so, as well as speaking about the sovereignty of the potter, God speaks about the loving kindness and the patience of God. For example, in verse 22, he speaks about God enduring with much patience certain men, in order to make known the riches of his glory to other certain men. There is a responsibility in us to respond to the sovereign God. And when God speaks to us today, he is not speaking to dead lumps of clay. You are not a mindless lump of clay. You're not mindless. You are not emotionless. You are not unconscionable without a conscience. You are clay with a soul and a conscience. You are dust with a destiny. And you are able to respond to Christ and the call of God under the gospel. And that is both the glory and the tragedy of man. Man is more than dust. He is dust with a destiny. He is dust with eternity at its heart. He is dust with a will to choose and a conscience to respond to Jesus Christ. And so I ask you this morning, broken clay, underneath the sovereignty of God, how does your will react to Jesus Christ this morning? How does your conscience respond to the word of the gospel today? That's the message of the broken clay. The second broken thing is the broken marriage, which is hinted at in verses 25 and 26, where Paul starts to speak about Hosea, the great prophet with the broken heart, and the broken home and the broken marriage, Christian scholars argue as to whether or not Gomer, his wife, was already a loose woman when he married her, or whether Hosea found out later on how empty and fickle a wife he had married. We read in chapter 1 of Hosea, God said to Hosea, go and take a loose woman. We read in chapter 3 of Hosea, God spake again and said, go again and marry the loose woman. And the feeling is that she had left him and they'd been divorced. But God said, no, you must go back again and marry her. You know the story. She was called Gomer. They had three children. The first child was a boy, and God said, call him Jezreel. And Hosea could scarcely believe his ears. Jezreel? That means God will sow judgment. God is going to broadcast judgment in the nation. However, the boy was called Jezreel. And then a second child was born. And God said, you will call this one Lo-Ruhamah. And again, Hosea could hardly believe his ears, because Lo-Ruhamah means unloved, not pitied. However, she was called Lo-Ruhamah. And then came a third child, a boy. And God said, you will call this one Lo-Ammi. And for the third time, Hosea could hardly believe his ears, because Lo-Ammi means not my people, not my child. He wasn't the father of this child. Was he the father of the other two children? Because to his pain and his cost, he discovered he was married to an empty woman, a giddy, vacant, fickle lady, forever chasing her boyfriends and her paramours, her lovers and her sweethearts. And the shocking thing was, that whole sordid story was a parable of God's relationship with his church. Three elements: a broken-hearted man, a fickle wife, and children of judgment. And the parable means a broken-hearted God, a fickle church, children of judgment. I think the thing that shook Hosea was that he discovered that she was incapable of love. She didn't know the difference between love and affection. She couldn't come to grips with true love. How strong it is. How determined and terrible and fierce a thing is true love. It's the love that brings men to heaven. It's the love that sadly allows them to go to hell. It is a mark of God's grace that out of the wretchedness of that broken marriage, with all its misery, its guilt, and its heartbreak, God brings a word of hope. The word of hope is this. I hope you're listening. Surely this is for somebody here today. Surely this is for somebody. That God takes the low ruchamas of this world, unloved and unpitied and uncomforted, and he says to them, my sweet one, you are lo ruchama no longer. Those days are finished. You are now ruchama, loved, pitied, comforted. And God takes the low amis of this world, not God's people, not religious, not churchy, not pious, strangers, foreigners and outcasts. God takes the non-entities and the nobodies. Lo ami. And he makes them ami, his children. All these people with no claims on the Father's grace are incorporated into the people of God. What's your name this morning? Is Lo Ruchama your middle name? Unloved, unpitied, uncomforted? Is Lo Ami your middle name? Not my people, not my child. Out of the broken marriage, a word of hope and a word of gospel help. And lastly, and very quickly, a word about the broken nation. And you find it referred to in verses 27-29. And Paul is quoting Isaiah, and he's speaking about the remnant, the doctrine of the remnant that you find in Isaiah. Verse 27, Isaiah cries out concerning Israel, although the number of the sons of Israel be as the sand of the sea, only a remnant of them will be saved. 29, and as Isaiah predicted, if the Lord of hosts had not left us children as a remnant, then we would have fared like Sodom and been made like Gomorrah. And in fact, Paul is simply continuing there what he's been saying throughout Romans, that there always have been two Israels and two churches and two bodies. There has always been an Israel inside Israel. There's always been a smaller church inside a much larger church. There has always been a spiritual people of God at the heart of the much larger church. I'm going to say something now, and I hope it doesn't really shock you. And yet I hope that it does shock you. There isn't really a Church of Scotland. We're called the Church of Scotland, but there isn't a Church of Scotland. There is a church in Scotland. It's made up of some Presbyterians, not all of them. Some Baptists, not all of them. Some Methodists, some Salvation Army, and so on. They make up the church in Scotland. And they make up the church because they are the remnant in the middle. They belong to Jesus Christ and they're born again of God's Spirit. Their sins have been forgiven and their hearts are the home of God. And that's what makes up the remnant. As I said last week, quoting one of the early church fathers, there is always an ecclesiola inside the ecclesia. ecclesiola in ecclesia, a little church inside the bigger church. And if you're not sure of whether you belong to the one or the other, you can discover by looking right at the end of the chapter. He speaks about the godless Gentiles in verse 30 coming to Christ, and in verse 31 about religious Israel failing to come to Christ, and the final test of whether you come or whether you don't lies at the end of this chapter, where Paul speaks about Christ as the rock in Zion. Behold, I'm laying in Zion a stone that will make men stumble, a rock that will make them fall. Well, you know, Christ is the rock, and you can do two things with the rock, just as you can do two things with Christ. You either stumble over it, or you stand on it. Which are you doing with Christ, the rock, today? Do you stumble over him? Or do you stand on him? Broken clay, a sovereign God, speaking to clay with consciences. A broken marriage. Lo Ruhama becomes pitied and loved. Lo Ami becomes a child of God. A broken nation. A remnant at the heart of the church. And the test of whether you're in or not. Where do you stand in relation to the rock? Do you stumble over him? Or do you stand on him? On Christ the solid rock I stand. All other ground, religion, pedigree, university degrees, good works, pious piety, all other ground is sinking sand. Amen. May the Lord add a blessing to the preaching of his word.